Welcome once again to our program, 14th session, Salvation History, the Old Testament, the story of creation, fall, and the beginning of the redemption of all humankind. Our guest again is Ron J. Eldred, who is teacher at John Paul II Catholic High, Religion and History, and I'm your host, Father Larry Moran, the chaplain down at Carmelites, just at the entrance to Allendale. Ron, welcome back. We got up in our story to the wonderful account of the birth and the childhood of Moses, who is such a towering figure in the Old Testament, the leader of his people. And Exodus, of course, tells us a lot about him. So could we begin our story of Moses and the Exodus, or the exiting out of Egypt, with the childhood of Moses, which is really fascinating in itself?
Moses was a son of a Hebrew Levite family. The Levites were descended of Jacob's son, Levi, but had been raised as an Egyptian by Pharaoh's daughter. Since the book of Exodus tells the story best, I'll quote quite a bit from that here for at least a few minutes. Quote, "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph." In other words, the Hyksos had been kicked out. They were closely related to the Hebrew peoples. And now there's Egyptians now who are actually ruling the country now. "And he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war befall us, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. And they built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramesses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they made the people of Israel serve with rigor. They made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick, and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they made them serve with rigor. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shipra, and the other Pua, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if he is a daughter, she shall live. But the midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and let the male children live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and are delivered before the midwife comes to them. So God dwelt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. Because the midwives fear God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all the people, every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. This story is told in Exodus 1.
Okay, that's a little opposite of what we see through history. Often it's the girl children who are killed, and the males are let to live. This sets the stage for the great towering figure of Moses and his birth. So how does the story continue?
Our story continues, and I'll quote a little bit again from Exodus. Quote, now a man from the house of Levi went and took a wife, a daughter of Levi. The woman conceived and bore a son. When she saw that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could hide him no longer, she took him in a basket and made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch, and so it wouldn't sink, of course, once it was put into the Nile. And she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds at the river's bank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. His sister, her name was Miriam. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and her maidens walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid to fetch it. And she opened it, she saw the child. And lo, the babe was crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrew children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. The child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter. And he became her son, and she named him Moses. For she said, "Because I drew him out of the water." This is told in Exodus 2. Since his mother had essentially raised him, at least up to a certain age, he would have no doubt known that he was a Hebrew. So Moses was raised, though, essentially as a prince and the foster grandson of the Pharaoh at the time.
What a story. And then what it's going to lead to.
You know, there's this little children's video they make, you know, it's called The Prince of Egypt.
Oh.
It tells the story of the Hanna-Barbera, I think.
Oh, really?
It's a series that, for children. We have copies of it. All of our grandkids have seen it several
Wonderful.
Times.
Well, it's such an interesting and historical story. Well, Moses loses favor, doesn't he, eventually with Pharaoh?
Yes, he does. As the story goes, after Moses grew up, he saw how the Egyptians mistreated his people, because as I said a while ago, he certainly had to know that he was a Hebrew. One day he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, and he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And the next day, when he went out, he tried to arbitrate an argument between two Hebrews. And he said to the man who had wronged him, "Why do you strike your fellow?" And the man answered him, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed your Egyptian, to kill the Egyptian?" Then Moses knew that his deed was known, and he became afraid. In fact, Pharaoh heard of the deed and sought to kill Moses. Some historians believe that the reigning pharaoh at the time was Seti I, and his mummy is located at Deir el-Bahari, Egypt. I've seen pictures of it before. Because he fell out of favor with Pharaoh, Moses had to flee to the east, to the land of Midian, which is on the Sinai Peninsula. There he met and married the daughter of a high priest of Midian. His name was Jethro. And his wife, was Zipporah. And she bore him two sons. That story is told in Exodus 2.
Okay, well, this brings us up to the extremely wonderful theophany, or appearance of God in the burning bush. Can you tell us about what Exodus says about that?
After Moses had lived in Midian for a number of years, if I recall right, it was something like 40 years, the Lord God, Yahweh, or Elohim, that was a name that was also used as God's name among the people at that time, revealed himself to him in the burning bush. The Catechism says of this event, quote, "God revealed himself progressively and under different names to his people. But the revelation that proved to be the fundamental one for both the Old and New Testaments was the revelation of the divine name to Moses in the theophany of the burning bush on the threshold of the Exodus and of the covenant on Sinai." And Moses was about 80 years old at this time, so he was getting to be a fairly old man.
Okay, since this story is really so critical to salvation history, Ron, can you give us some more details?
The story of the burning bush as told in the book of Exodus is as follows, and I'll read some parts of this from the Bible because it tells the story the best. Quote, "Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness, and came to Horeb, also called Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and lo, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside and see this great sign. Why, the bush is not burnt. He sees it off in a distance, you see. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see God, God called him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. And he said, do not come near. Put off your shoes from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the Lord of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. This story is told in Exodus 3. Then the Lord said, I have seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, in the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Those are the people who are living, of course, in the land of Canaan, the promised land, the land that God had promised to Abraham originally. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have seen the oppression for which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring forth my people, the sons of Egypt, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? He said, but I will be with you. This is God telling him this. And this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you when you have brought forth the people out of Egypt. You shall serve God upon this mountain. Then Moses said to God, this is really getting to the climax now, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is your name? What shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who am. Sometimes you see it translated, I am who I am, as well. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord of God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt, and I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. This goes on in Genesis 13, 17. Moses made an excuse that he couldn't speak very well. In other words, he didn't really want to go. He was afraid to go. He couldn't speak very well, but God told him he could speak through his brother Aaron. He also had a sister named Miriam who also played an important part in our story.
It's interesting the way God keeps talking about going back to the beginning. I'm the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. As if he wants to keep this history together, where they've come from and where they're going. Well, Ron, what did God mean by calling himself, I am who am? That's a tough one.
Yes, it is. One rendition of God's name is Yahweh. And in this regard, the Catechism states that, quote, God revealed himself to his people Israel by making his name known to them. A name expresses a person's essence and identity and the meaning of this person's life. God has a name. He is not an anonymous force. To disclose one's name is to make oneself known to others. In a way, it is to hand oneself over by becoming accessible, capable of being known more intimately, and addressed personally, end of quote. It states elsewhere that, quote, the revelation of the ineffable name, I am who am, contains then the truth that God alone is, and that is in two capital letters. The Greek Septuagint, translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, and following is the church's tradition, understood the divine name in this sense. God is the fullness of being and of every perfection, without origin and without end. All creatures receive all that they are and have from him, but he alone is his very being, and he is of himself everything that he is. End of quote. By really revealing his name, God shows that he's a person. He's personal. In fact, as we know, he's three persons. And he can carry on a personal relationship with his human creatures. The Trinity of three divine persons is implicit several places in the Old Testament, and of course this is in one of the places. It's also back in the book of Genesis, several places.
Let us make implicit. Man to our image and likeness, for instance.
But it wasn't until Jesus came, into the world and revealed in the New Testament that God is actually three persons in one God. Well, more specifically, I am who am means that God is one and is absolutely sovereign, that his existence is dependent on no other being, nor is he subject to any other force. It means that he is transcendent. That means, of course, he's beyond and above his creation. But at the same time, he's immanent. That is, he's also close to his creation. He's not his creation, that's pantheism, but he's close to his creation. He's a personal God who is all good and loves and cares about his creatures. Philosophically, I am, or Yahweh, means that God is pre-existent being. That's the kind of the terminology you would see in St. Thomas Aquinas, for example. I teach a class at John Paul Catholic High School where we look at that kind of thing in some detail. What that means, all that type of thing means, being.
And that's a staggering concept, without beginning and without end.
Yes, he's existence itself. He's the very source. He's the creator, the sustainer of all that is. Another way that it can be said is he who is, or the existing one. St. Augustine called God the supreme reality, or existence in itself. God has no past. He lives in the eternal present. He just simply is. He is pure being. As I said in the class that I teach, we talk about what does that mean, being, and all that. You'll get definitions for it, and really go into that in some detail. As St. Thomas would say, St. Thomas Aquinas, God's essence and his existence are identical. That takes a long time to explain that.
Right, that's a staggering thought.
Yes. And as we shall see when we study the New Testament, Jesus referred to himself on several occasions as I am, which is the main reason the Jewish leadership killed him. That is, they killed him because he was claiming to be God, and they realized that.
And that was that great reference back to the burning bush.
Yes.
When God identified to Moses what his name was. So knowing that history, and that was deeply embedded in the Jewish people, that wonderful story of the burning bush, how it had talked to Moses and given his mission, and God told him what his name was.
In fact, the name of God was so holy to the Jews, the Jewish people, that they didn't even speak the name. They would not say Yahweh or Elohim. They would refer to God as Lord. In fact, if you see even in Orthodox Jews today, any of their writings or on their websites or anything like that, they don't spell out the name God. They have G-D, and they don't spell out the whole name.
And of course, that's one of the places we get the second commandment, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. As you explained there before, certainly a person's name was much more probably in olden days rather than in modern days, trying to describe a person, their mission, or what they were. Abraham was changed, Abram was changed to Abraham, father of many nations. Simon's name was Peter, rock.
Jacob to Israel.
Jacob, Israel.
Saul the Paul, and there's quite a few.
So,
in fact, the God's name was so holy to the Jewish people in the time we're talking about here that one could be executed for using God's name in vain.
Okay. Well, that was considered blasphemy.
Yes.
And that was the very thing, as you mentioned earlier, that Jesus was condemned for. He has blasphemed.
Think how people loosely use it today, though.
Oh, right. You know, just almost say a byword. There's an old Latin saying, nomen name, nomen est omen. The name is the sign or the explanation, telling us something very important about the person. But that doesn't necessarily happen much in modern times when we're named after movie stars or anybody else. But in the Old Testament especially, and even in the New, name has a peculiar connection with one's mission.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, Moses went back to Egypt and he confronted Pharaoh after fleeing. So tell us the story of his going back to confront Pharaoh. And according as the spiritual said, let my people go. That's one of the famous black spirituals.
Yeah, thus saith the Lord, let my people go. When Moses returned to Egypt, he went to see Pharaoh to comply with the Lord's wishes. And of course, he took Aaron with him. Some scholars believe that the reigning Pharaoh at the time was Ramses II, known to history as Ramses the Great. In fact, his mummy is now on display at the museum in Cairo. I've seen pictures of that, too, as well. In fact, I've seen several programs on it and some of the documentary channels over the years. Since Moses had a speech impediment, that's why he took his brother with him to speak for him. And it took 10 miraculous plagues to force Pharaoh to let the Israelites go.
Well, how did Pharaoh react to Moses and Aaron's request that the Israelites be freed and be able to go out and worship in the desert according to God's own call?
Yeah, right off the bat, Moses didn't ask. He's using a little psychology here. He didn't say, let my people go and let us go back to our, you know, to our homeland. The Hebrew people were too valuable to the Egyptians as, you know, servants and slaves to confront Pharaoh, at least in that way, right off the bat. Aaron, speaking for Moses, said to Pharaoh, quote, thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. In other words, just to go out and have a feast for 3 days. But Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should heed his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord. And moreover, I will not let Israel go. And he said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Let us go, we pray, 3 days' journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest we fall upon us with pestilence or with sword. But the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people away from their work? Get to your burdens. And Pharaoh said, behold, the people of the land are now many, and you make them rest from their burdens. The same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their foremen, you shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as heretofore. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. See, before they at least provided the straw for them, now they got to go gather the straw as well. In other words, they're just piling on more work. But the number of bricks which they had made heretofore, you shall lay upon them, and shall by no means lessen it, for they are idle. Therefore they cry, let us go and offer sacrifice to our God. Let heavier work be laid upon the men, that they may labor at it, and paid no regard to lying words. That story is told in Genesis 5. In other words, the king was saying that if you have enough free time in your hands to go into the wilderness for 3 days to worship your God, then you have too much time on your hands, and you need to have more work piled on to occupy your time.
Boy, real difficulty. How did the Israelites react to this heavier burden being placed on them, trying to make bricks without the straw provided, and they had to find it all around.
Well, naturally, the Israelites blame Moses and Aaron. Keep in mind now that Moses had not yet established his authority among the Israelites. In fact, his authority was challenged many times during their wandering in the desert wilderness for 40 years. Because Pharaoh refused to listen, God sent 10 plagues to Egypt. The plagues are as follows: water turned to blood, frogs, gnats or lice, flies, cattle disease, boils, hail, locusts, darkness, and the deaths of all the Egyptian firstborn. The 10th plague is the terrible Passover of the angel of death, which took the lives of all the firstborn of the Egyptians, people and animals as well. That story is told in Exodus 8 through 11.
And then after these 10 awful plagues, how did Pharaoh respond?
He paid little attention to the first two plagues because his court magicians could produce something that resembled them. However, the magicians failed to produce the third plague, the plague of gnats, and they admitted that this is the finger of God. Nonetheless, Pharaoh still wouldn't give in. When God inflicted the fourth plague on Egypt, the swarming of countless flies, it became even more evident or obvious that it was the Israelite God who was causing this plague, especially since the flies covered all of Egypt except for the land of Goshen, where the Israelites happened to be living. And so, in fact, only the Egyptians were afflicted by all of these plagues.
Okay, as our time's running down, I think we have little time. Why did God inflict these particular plagues on Egypt?
Well, in a nutshell, each of the plagues represented a refutation of an Egyptian god. And many scientists have pointed out that each of the plagues can be explained as a natural phenomenon in Egypt. And we'll spend the next, since our time is about to run out, we'll spend the next session, the whole session, just taking a look at these plagues and see what various scholars have had to say about this whole issue of the 10 plagues.
Okay, so today we hardly ever connect some kind of physical disaster with God trying to get a message through to us, but the Old Testament just takes it for granted that destruction and plagues and are the way that God tries to shake his people, the enemies of his people, into paying attention. So may God bless you all always and in all ways.